This is Solidarity News on Radio Labour.
This is a Radio Labour World Report recorded on Friday, October 23rd, 2020. I'm Mark Belanger. In the report this week, why the extradition of Julian Assange to the United States could criminalize journalism. 20,000 higher education workers in Australia are about to lose their jobs. The Labour Start report about union events and singing.
Hold that line, sisters, brothers, never weaken, stand and hold that picket line.
This is Radio Labour. The United States is trying to extradite Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, from the United Kingdom. U.S. government lawyers say Mr. Assange, an Australian citizen, illegally obtained and published classified information related to the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The charges include accusations that he worked with Chelsea Manning to hack computers and spread classified documents. To find out more about the extradition and the hearings which were held in September, I talked to Tim Dawson. Mr. Dawson is a member of the National Executive of the National Union of Journalists in Britain and Ireland. He attended the extradition hearings on behalf of the NUJ and the International Federation of Journalists. I began my conversation with Mr. Dawson by asking him why the extradition of Julian Assange is an issue for journalists.
Because the successful prosecution of Julian Assange would have the effect of criminalising journalism. Let me explain why that is. To understand this, you need to look at the what's known as the second superseding indictment of Julian Assange. So this is where the United States sets out the terms on which it wishes to prosecute Mr. Assange. These are all in the US Espionage Act of 1917, which is a very vague and quite a notorious piece of legislation for persecuting progressives and working class organizers and trade unionists. And within the terms of this act, it defines what it seeks to prosecute Assange for, which is effectively nurturing a contact who he hopes to obtain information from and helping that contact to locate information that he thinks might be of use and providing advice on how he might sidestep the security of the computer network from which he's going to take that information. Now, those actions are ones that thousands of investigative journalists will have performed many, many times. They are the actions of somebody locating and coaching a source, somebody who has recognized illegality or immorality within an organization that they're working for and helping them to provide that information for journalistic purposes. So in a way, whether you think Julian Assange is a journalist or an activist or whatever, doesn't really matter because it's the actions that he took which are journalistic for which the US is trying to prosecute him. And if they are successful, it will mean that anybody engaging in that kind of work with classified material would be at risk of prosecution by the US, which is a frankly terrifying prospect.
I have heard it said that Mr. Assange used his journalistic expertise to interfere in a US election and so deserves to be punished. How do you respond to this?
Well, so this relates to the leak of emails within the Democratic National Committee in 2016. That event plays no part in the attempt to prosecute Assange whatsoever. So nothing relating to that leak and how that happened is mentioned in any of the US case. I myself wonder about how that leak happened and why it came out as it did. I understand why some might think that even if this isn't what Assange is charged for, maybe he deserves it. But I suppose fundamentally I believe in the rule of law, and if criminal acts somehow led to those leaks or were involved in those leaks coming to light, then let the relevant authorities place those charges in front of a court and let's hear the evidence. As things stand, they play no part whatsoever in the case that's currently ongoing.
What happens next?
Well, in early January, the judge who has been hearing this case will hand down her ruling. The closing submissions of defence and prosecution will be submitted in writing in the coming weeks, so we might hear some stories from those. And she will rule either that Assange is to be extradited or she will deny the extradition. I think if she rules that he is to be extradited, then you can expect to see this back in court and for that process to take really quite some time. It's hard to find exactly comparable cases, but if you look at the case of Abu Hamza, who was extradited from Britain to face justice in the United States, the period from his arrest in the UK to his final prosecution in the United States was about a decade. And I think that gives some sense of how long this has the potential to drag on for, you know, to the considerable detriment of Mr. Assange, I don't doubt, and cost to the British taxpayer.
One of the sectors being hit hardest by the pandemic is higher education. To find out what's been happening, Education International has conducted a series of webinars about the issue. EI is the global union for teachers and other educators. One of the participants in a webinar about COVID and the higher education sector was Matthew McGowan, the General Secretary of the National Tertiary Education Union in Australia, the NTEU.
Around about 30% of the funding for the sector comes now from international student income. And that has had the closing of the borders and the shutting down of international travel has really dramatically changed climate for the university sector. So the most dramatic impact on the sector is a loss of some $3.5 to $4 billion in this year alone. And if we project forward into next year and the following year, the full estimates are looking pretty grim. That number could easily double or triple. We are in a very serious position. All of our universities are starting to lay staff off, particularly you'll find that casual staff are being laid off in very large numbers. We are facing a crisis within our institutions in the research front. Most of our universities cross-subsidise research from the international student income. Governments of all persuasions over the last couple of decades have used international students as excuses to expand the sector, but also to reduce the government's responsibility for fully funding the sector. And so increasingly what we've seen is institutions become dependent upon that international student income for their very existence and for the funding of many of their activities, including research. It is a very serious problem. We are seeing at the moment, we are expecting something of the order of 20,000 jobs to disappear out of the sector over the next 6 to 9 months. The government has done nothing to provide any support to the sector so far. We have a budget coming up and it's quite possible that there will be some relief provided to the institutions, but it's unlikely to go anywhere near the losses that the institutions are facing. So our major crisis at the moment is holding on to people's jobs. We are seeing people terminated at a really rapid rate. Some 4,000 contract staff are up at the end of this year. Those are primarily research staff. The people who are most dramatically affected, there are courses being cut all over the place. Probably the lion's share of those full-time job losses will go to the professional staff as the institutions cut back as much as they possibly can. The institutions and the government, in some ways, are using the crisis to further objectives that they may have already had in their back pockets and that they have been pursuing for some time.
Here with his report about union events is Labour Start correspondent Derek Blackadder.
Each day, Labour Start's volunteers collect hundreds of news items about the struggles of workers and their unions from around the world in 36 languages. Here's a small sample of all their work. Our top stories section included links to coverage of the imprisonment this week of the leadership of the Railway Workers Union of Thailand, who received 3-year sentences for their union's workplace health and safety campaign. We also covered an all-women hunger strike by Albanian oil workers and why a group of garment workers in Myanmar are continuing their fight to organize despite the repression they face. This week, the emerging trends in our news coverage include the organizing efforts by domestic workers, most of them also women and migrants, as the immediate shock of the pandemic wears off. Many of these efforts are the result of work done by the newest of the global union federations, the International Domestic Workers Federation. The pandemic's impact on domestic workers has been particularly acute in Africa and in parts of Asia. Countries from which migrant workers originate are seeing far less in remittances to workers' families, while the workers themselves are routinely abandoned by employers and governments in the countries in which they were working. In most cases, such workers have been forced to depend on charity for survival. Another long-standing COVID-19-related global crisis has been the difficulty ship crews have been having in getting off their ships and to their homes. The International Transport Workers Federation and its affiliates representing ship crews have been working to ensure safe paths home for these workers, but the negotiations are complicated by the number of governments involved in what might have been, just a year ago, a simple connecting flight. As with the domestic workers crisis, the inability of ship crews to return home has consequences for other workers. Whilst one crew may be forced to remain aboard long after the worker should have gone on leave, another crew is forced to sit at home without an income. For our Working Women page, our volunteers found news of the challenges facing women sheep shearers in New Zealand and a comparison of the effects of the pandemic on garment workers in Bangladesh and Vietnam. The Free Health and Safety Newswire we offer in cooperation with Hazards Magazine carried stories about the results of a long-term study of heat exposure amongst American workers, and one about the overwork and other stressors on healthcare workers everywhere as their numbers diminish in countries where the second wave of the pandemic has hit, driving workers into other occupations. Our current photo of the week is of the first-ever energy sector protest in Mongolia. The picket took place last week to protest violence against women union activists and management corruption. Current campaigns we are running at the request of unions around the world include an urgent appeal for online solidarity with garment workers in Myanmar who produce sporting goods for global brands and who have been under attack since they first attempted to organize. Look for details of this and other campaigns on our site. This is Derek Blackadder from Labor Start, reporting for Radio Labor.
Now here is Robin Roberts with Hold That Line.
Hold that line, hold that line. Sisters, brothers, never we can stand and hold that picket line. We're standing here together, one for all and all for one. And we'll keep right on here standing till our victory we have won. We're united in our struggle, no, there's none us can divide. We'll yield nothing to the enemy, cause we've justice on our side. Sing now, hold that line, hold that line. Sisters, brothers, never we can stand and hold that picket line. Hold that line, hold that line. Sisters, brothers, never we can stand and hold that picket line. Hold that line against the bosses when they try to drive us back. Hold that line against the coppers and their armed baton attacks. Hold that line against the government, against all enemies of our class. Hold that line against the scabs to know we'll never let them pass. Hold that line, hold that line. Sisters, brothers, never we can stand and hold that picket line. Hold that line against the World Bank and against the IMF. Hold that line and keep on holding it as long as we have breath. Hold that line against their dogma. Hold that line against their creed. Hold that line to save the future from their plunder and their greed. We're standing with the millions reaching out across this world, and with those who fought before us, our banners here unfurled. But there's more room yet beside us if you'll come and join our cause. For the chains that now enslave you, they're all you've got to lose. Hold that line, hold that line. Sisters, brothers, never we can stand and hold that picket line.
Hold That Line was written by Peter Hicks and Jeff Francis. And that's it, international labor news you can use. You can find our features and daily newscasts on our website at radiolabor.net. I'm Mark Belanger. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about global solidarity.